Welcome to the Review Improve podcast, where we are dedicated to personal growth in a practical way for the 21st century. I'm your host, Sam Rust, along with my co-host, Brad Luce. Brad, 4th of July today. We're dating ourselves a little bit in this podcast, but did you guys enjoy the parade? Your little guy enjoyed candy and all the other free goodies that came his direction?
He had more candy than he's ever seen. It was about raining down on him. But he enjoyed the cars, the horses, the floats, everything that came with all that. So we're doing good. How are you guys?
Doing excellent. Doing excellent. We've had a little bit of a heat wave, and we're still recovering from a hailstorm that actually hit us one of the last times that we recorded. We ended up having some significant roof damage from lime-sized hail. It was changed my definition of hail, that's for sure. But overall, going well, and excited to be joining you today to talk about Pour No More. I think this is a really appropriate book for today. Celebrating Independence, Pour No More is written by Peter Cove back in 2017. Peter has been in the war on poverty. He's been at the front lines of that battle really since its inception in the 60s under Lyndon B. Johnson, and wrote this book really as a rebuttal to how most government programs are run today that are focused on solving poverty. I overall really enjoyed the book. A lot of thought-provoking stuff. Peter personally experienced an ideological shift. Started out very progressive or liberal, whatever word you want to use, back in the 60s. And then as he put his own ideas and worldview into action in the war on poverty, started evolving and ended up today. He's founder of American Works, which is a for-profit organization dedicated to getting people into jobs as quickly as possible. And this book kind of outlines his ideological shift. What did you think of the book? First impressions, Brad?
It was, again, this was a book similar to the Perils of Privilege book, where I would not have read it unless we were doing this podcast. I learned a lot from it. It really changed some of my views and outlooks on free education, college-wise, how to either educate people to get them in the workforce or just overall get more people into the workforce and off the streets. I learned a lot. It really changed, like I said, changed how I think about some things and how I view people who are in poverty. So I don't want to say like I enjoyed it, but it was a good read.
It was a good read. All right. Yeah, it was intellectually stimulating for me. I think there's just a lot of things to unpack in this book, and we're definitely not going to touch everything that Peter does in our 45 minutes or so together here today. But I thought it'd be helpful to kind of start with a couple of foundational concepts, and really the how you answer a couple of these questions define your solution toolbox that you're going to go out and try to solve, whether it's a social ill or a cultural ill, especially surrounding poverty. But it really comes down to who causes poverty. That's a really big question that Peter touches several times, especially at the beginning of the book. And there's really two main answers in American thought today. There's the thought that society is to blame, that that society has failed the individual through lack of opportunity, lack of education, maybe outright oppression. The other side would be, and again, painting with broad strokes here, but that the individual is responsible, generally speaking, that they didn't show enough initiative, didn't take advantages of the opportunities that were afforded them being here in America, and so on and so forth. Again, I don't think either camp would necessarily say 100% well, society is 100% to blame, or the individual is 100% to blame. But if we're painting with broad strokes, again, that's generally where people land. Brad, I'm curious, where do you land on that spectrum?
Yeah, so originally I viewed it all as they're low income people or people in poverty are that way because they want to be that way, or they don't, they're just not willing to put a foot forward and do some hard work or whatever. That's where kind of my background of mind of thought is. But reading this book, it really changed it, because he starts talking about how the government has made it so easy for people to just be assisted by the government and actually earn more not working than working. So I'm still figuring out where I stand now that I've read this book and how I think about it and my exact thought. But that's kind of where I came from, was I always viewed people like, oh, they would rather not work, sit comfortable and let the government help them out than actually put in a good day's hard work and earn some money.
And I think something that Peter says in his book is, in our process of trying to create a safety net for, again, we're going to call it the low income spectrum. In the process of creating a safety net, what we've really done in our war on poverty over the last 50 years is create a safety web. We've created a web of programs that catch people and don't release them. We're not improving people's states. Some of the statistics in the book were just staggering to me. So 1965 is Lyndon Johnson's famous declaration of the war on poverty. Between 1965 and 2013, the low income rate, or the poverty line, the number of people living below the poverty line, has gone from 17.3% to 14.5%, which, I mean, this is not that much. I mean, we're talking almost 3% change, albeit it is change in the right direction. But to achieve that level of change in 2013 dollars, we've spent $22 trillion. That's trillion with a T. That's basically our national debt right there. Now, obviously, we spend money in a lot more places than just on welfare programs. But generally, our national debt consists of social programs, all dedicated to the war on poverty. And we haven't won. We haven't made an appreciable difference. I just find that fascinating and, frankly, pretty disturbing. And one of the things that Peter really talks a lot about is that people in America, specifically in social programs, that government designers, they're focused on the process and not on the results. And I found that to be a really interesting observation. I don't have a whole lot of firsthand experience with any of the programs that are talked about, whether it's welfare, you know. Again, if we're going to go back to privilege, I've been privileged with being in a position in life where I don't have to rely on any of those. I just don't interact with a ton of people that are involved in those social programs. So, yeah, I, again, don't have much in the way of firsthand experience, but it was just so interesting to see how he cast government agencies as not caring about results, but instead the process. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, in the book, he said, in public policy, we should deduce our theory from practice. Unfortunately, most people in business of helping the poor turn that principle upside down, proposing theories first and then basing programs on them. And that's something that I know we can see, and we do see a lot, where these programs that the government have for helping the poor and these non-for-profits, they don't really measure their results, at least that we can publicly see, or that is in a good way so that we can look at the results and the data and say, all right, this isn't working, this is working. And that's really something, I think, a big point that I got from the book, and that he repeats it over and over in the book, is like, we need to measure what we're doing and figure out what works and what doesn't work. He's like, all these programs, these money is just being dumped into these programs that we don't even know it works. Like, yeah, we can see that, oh, maybe a few people are getting a hand up or they're moving up, but overall, how many people go through the program and just end up where they still are?
Yeah, it's amazing the amount of money that we've dumped into programs that we didn't even have a proof of concept. The program itself was the proof of concept. And, you know, in Eat That Frog, and then again in Richest Man in Babylon, it's really come up in several of the books that we've done, but we've talked about the need to have a plan, to have a goal, know what your goal is, know what your why is, and then come up with specific steps that you can implement and you can measure yourself against to see if you're making appreciable progress towards your goal. And really what we're doing here is we're seeing that in our governmental sphere, in our social program sphere, we've abandoned that methodology. We've abandoned any really rationality. If it feels good and if it is getting resources of any kind into the poor's hands, no matter what they do with it or how they utilize the resources, it must therefore be a good thing. Again, painting with a really broad brush here, but that is when you dive in a little bit deeper and you realize that, I'm not surprised that we've only made 2.8% change in the poverty level in the last 50 years.
He also talks about how it used to be looked down upon to be on welfare. As if you were on welfare, people would be like, why, what happened? Like, what's wrong with you? Why are you not working or trying harder? But now it's the norm. It's normal to have help from the government to buy food or buy gas or with childcare or whatever you have it. It's normal to be buying convenience food from a grocery store with food stamps. I mean, I see people do this all the time here in California. And the switch is why the economy is starting to fall. I mean, this is like a little rabbit trail. But in a way, this is why the economy here in the United States is starting to fall behind other countries. We no longer, as a country, look at hard work, making minimum wage as a way to get ahead. It's more like, oh, I'll never be able to get ahead, so why even put the foot forward? Because the government has me. They have this net that I can just fall back onto.
Well, and it comes back to how do you view the cause of poverty? Is it, by and large, a lack of personal responsibility, or is it by and large a product of society? And I fall firmly on the side of personal responsibility. Not saying that there aren't situations where circumstances align or injustice is committed, but generally, I think that we should design our programs with the idea of encouraging people to take personal responsibility and personal ownership in their own standing, again, from an economic point of view. I don't think that society or capitalism or whatever boogeyman you want to throw in there is by and large the issue that we're seeing in supposed income inequality today. I mean, it feels like every day you open a website and one of the top headlines is income inequality is growing. We are losing that personal responsibility. And again, we've talked about this in several different podcasts and thinking specifically of privilege, but I do think it comes down to some fundamental issues of how you view people and how you view responsibility.
Yeah. And another thing that America is starting to lose sight of is that as you get more specialized jobs, as the economy and the products are coming out, you need really fine knowledge on what you're making. Some people are going to be making a lot more money because they have a lot more fine knowledge about this complex issue or design than other people who are doing something else. And that's okay. I mean, we don't want a doctor who's going to be doing heart surgery to be making the same as the janitor sweeping the floors. I mean, we want to reward people for having the knowledge and working hard to save people's lives. But people are starting, at least from what the people I've talked to and what I've read lately, is people starting to lose sight of that. As there's a lot of, a lot of people say rich people in Silicon Valley, but they're also making a lot finer products and a lot more detailed knowledge in some things than someone making, I don't know, cardboard boxes in a factory in the central United States. I mean, that's not a bad thing. They're good jobs either way. But that's something I've seen people starting to lose sight of as I'm talking about income inequality and going down those paths.
Yeah. Well, and something that Peter touches on very early on in the book is a lot of people came to the war on poverty straight from the war on Jim Crow and segregation. And so they brought that same mindset. Jim Crow, segregation, racism, I mean, that's a stain on our history as a nation. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. That's just a bad chapter, a horrible chapter of our nation that we're still, frankly, trying to overcome today. And ultimately, it's a moral issue. Can you treat somebody who's the same as you, except for their skin color, the same or not? That's a moral issue. But they took that moral outlook and then they applied it to poverty when really it's not that simple. I can look at anybody. It doesn't matter their gender, their race, their ethnicity, their economic status, and they should be deserving of, you know, a lot of the same rights, all the same rights under the Constitution of the United States. But that doesn't extend into the economic sphere or the cultural sphere. Those are two different paradigms. And when they brought that morality from segregation and racism into the war on poverty, they brought the wrong tools to try to solve the problem. I found that really interesting that Peter traced that even in his own evolution of worldview. You know, him personally, he attributes a lot of his failings early on in his career as a social worker to trying to make it a moral fight instead of understanding that this is a complex economic and cultural fight to try to eliminate poverty.
Yeah, I agree. I thought this was a very interesting concept that I personally have never thought about before. With the racial protests, they were trying to change the thoughts and laws that were the ground into who we as a country are or were. But when it comes to poverty, it's a completely different scenario. You can't do sit-ins in the politicians' offices to change the laws on poverty. I mean, that's not how it works. Poverty is about individuals rather than the society. It's how a person thinks of himself, his mindset on work, and what he quote-unquote deserves. Again, going back to the mindset that this country was founded on, we were founded on hard work, but now it's slightly changed to where people are more like what we deserve or what we need or get. People don't want to do the jobs that are quote-unquote under them, mowing yards, cleaning bathrooms. I see a lot of Americans who are just like, no, I'm not willing to start there and work my way up, or I'm not willing to do that job for a little while or whatever needs be. And I've been telling, this is a little rabbit path of mine, but I've been telling people a lot lately, is when, as we're talking about sending the Hispanics and people back to their home countries, if we do that, I mean, they're willing to start on the bottom and work their way up. And we as Americans need to get back to that. If we send a whole bunch of people back to Mexico or their home country, there's going to be a void that American people are not going to want to fill. Yes, if we can get the people in poverty to start doing those jobs, it would create more jobs, we'd get people in to work again, and as a whole, the economy start boosting up as American people. But yeah, I mean, you can't do going back to the original question, you can't do an Occupy City Hall protest to change how an individual thinks about himself, or if he could hold a job or want to work in that job.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I'm not even going to go too far down this trail, but the answer is not raising the minimum wage. I'd love to do a more economics-based book at some point and dive into some of the economics around why raising the minimum wage doesn't work. But anywhere that we've risen the minimum wage in the United States to 12, 15 bucks an hour, the number of jobs available drops. It's just a fact. Minimum wage job wasn't meant to support somebody. And if you work hard, you won't be in a minimum wage job. It's just, these are facts. And I look forward to again, a future podcast where we can dive into some of that and learn a little bit more. But staying on track here, we talked already about how we really haven't looked at the results of these programs and looked at what we had wanted them to achieve, the Job Corps, food stamps, welfare, Social Security, disability, on and on and on. Why is that? And can we change that? And it was mind-boggling to me, the amount of patronage that was involved, that it really is politicians trading money for votes. And, you know, generally, that's not a good way to run a country. And I think that we see results of that. I mean, you look at any major metropolitan area, I mean, it doesn't matter where you're at, whether it's Detroit or San Francisco or New York, or most major cities in America have deep problems around poverty and how to deal with poverty. But we keep putting the same people in place, the same programs in place, and nothing is changing. And we've got to step back as a country and look at what has worked, what hasn't worked, and let's go change this. And it's this system of patronage of community organizers getting money from government and then going out and rallying their communities to vote for whoever gave them the most money that has just sent us down this bad spiral of this feedback loop of inefficiency and poor results. It's frankly astounding.
He says in the book, he's like, there's a conspiracy to forswear performance for political support. I mean, it honestly, it astounded me just reading the example after example of where he would bring it, his company, and just clarify for people, he was running a for-profit company to help people get out of poverty rather than a non-for-profit, which was unheard of, still is unheard of. People just don't do that. It's like, why would you try and make a profit off of people in poverty? That's kind of the mindset people go off of. But it's extremely successful in his programs running a for-profit for getting people out of poverty. But he just brings example after example of where he would show his methods and his company to politicians and to even presidents of the United States. And people would just say, no, I'm going to go with this other program that's not tried or true because they'll get me the votes. And that ultimately, that's what it came down to. They didn't really care about changing. They didn't really care that he could for sure bring huge success changes to cities and urban areas. They just cared about getting in office with the votes.
There was even, I think, in Ohio and then in New York City, they started the program. They had phenomenal results a year in. And then the establishment social work groups, whatever you want to call those, came in and got them defunded. Not because of their results, but because the way that they were achieving those results was really antithetical to the rest of the social work complex. That raised my blood pressure a couple of points right there.
Yeah, same here. I was just like, are you serious? Is this where we are as a country?
Yeah. Well, and going back again, not to beat a dead horse here, but going back to whose fault is poverty, generally, if you believe that society is the problem, then you're going to try to solve that through education. It's not a straight one-to-one ratio there, but generally, and I think a lot of people view education as the component, the best tool that will solve poverty. And that's really the way majority of social programs are designed today. Let's get these people in. Let's train them. Let's give them education for, you know, whatever tasks they're going to be going into, programming or even social work or various things. And then let's get them a job. Peter makes the point, and the goal of his program is not to educate people. It's to get, he's designed his for-profit enterprise, America Works, that he gets paid really based on two metrics. How many people does he get into a job, and how long, and do they stay in their job, their job retention rate? Those are the two things that he's measured on, and those are the two things that he's paid on. So he's aligning market forces and incentive structures with really what the goals of social programs should be. The goal of any social program dedicated to fighting poverty should be, let's get people a job and let's help them keep a job. I think that goal is universal, but we're not, again, looking at the goal and then working backwards to getting steps in place to get that done.
Yeah, and something that's set up with his company is that they do not get paid unless the people they're helping stay in jobs and are a success. If they don't succeed as getting people into jobs and on their path out of poverty, they don't get paid. So it's not rather like they get this funding from the government and they all have all this money and then it doesn't matter what the results are. It's no, they don't get money unless they get results. And ultimately, that's the way that the private market works. You don't succeed in a business unless you get results. And it should be the same for nonprofits. It should be the same for the companies getting the government money. But again, we don't have a good standard measuring metric for those companies and nonprofits to decide whether they actually get money. It goes back to just the votes and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And feeling like you're accomplishing things. And bringing that whole conversation full circle, Peter's foundation's work, or his company's work, America's Work, is not, let's educate and then place. And I think based on some of our conversations on this podcast, Brad, that was more of your mindset even, was let's educate. Let's make sure that we have a good education. You know, maybe we can dive back into our free college for everyone here. And that's really the way that a lot of social programs are designed, is let's educate and then let's get them a job. But why hasn't that worked, in your opinion?
Good question. Something that I got out of it, and as I did more reading on the side about it, and it's an old topic. I think we should do a book on education sometime. But in our education system these days, a lot of kids get burned. And a lot of people in poverty, they struggle in school. Not all of them, but it's like it's known. I don't have any data right now to back it up, but people in poverty most times struggle in school. And he was talking about that a little in the book. And then they get burned by the education system. And so then they kind of are on this downward spiral. So then when this non-for-profit comes along and says, hey, let's educate you more so you can get a better job, or you can get a job. They're already burned by the educational system, so they don't want to go back into an educational system to help them get out of poverty. They already have this anti-educational system or anti-school mindset. And I mean, there are a lot of good teachers out there and a lot of good schools, but I think it comes back to the basics of our educational system.
I think a big part of it goes even beyond education and the state of our education system. I agree. I'd love to cover that topic and learn more about it. I think it really comes down to personal responsibility. I keep saying that. But if you have a good work ethic and if you're willing to step out and work hard, education really won't be a limiting factor for you. I can think of hundreds of examples. Eli Whitney, Charles Goodyear, all these inventors back 200 years ago, even college dropouts like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, where because they had a great idea or they were willing to work and they were really curious, they completely overcame their lack of formal education. And I think that that's something that's important to recognize, that education in itself will never solve poverty. We could all be masters. We could all have MBAs. That's not going to solve poverty. I guarantee you. What would solve poverty is if everybody in America had an excellent work ethic and took personal responsibility for their career path. If we did that, I guarantee you poverty would be in the low single digits, if not below. It's just a... That's the way that it's designed. So we have to design our social programs in ways that recognize that, that don't put a premier emphasis on education, but instead give an emphasis on getting into the workplace, becoming a productive, valued member of society. As Peter says, work socializes. It gives one a sense of purpose and dignity. It nourishes the soul. There's a ton of scientific evidence on the relationship between work and health, physical health. Unemployment is shown to increase rates of sickness, disability, mental health problems, and ultimately to decrease life expectancy. And so I think Peter is really onto something with his America Works company to get people into jobs and then support them once they're in those jobs. Education isn't not important. It's definitely important, especially as you want to advance, but it's not a prerequisite to entering the workforce.
Yeah, and another thing is a lot of the job placement education facilities don't work closely or very close at all with the companies, employers, and the general market that they're placing people into. And so then they're educating people for something that's not even needed anymore or that's outdated, that's not going to help them at all. So then they get out in the workforce and they're like, why did I just spend a whole bunch of time in that facility learning stuff when there's no way I can use it? You have to make sure that both of the goals are aligned with both the job placement, education facilities, and the market that you're placing people into. He talks a lot about how people are trained for jobs that do not exist. And that goes back again, I mean, at least on the educational side, the nonprofit side, it's because people don't really care if the system works. So they're just pumping numbers through. If they can show that they put 100,000 people through their system, then they might get more money. And they think they know best, so they're not going to change anything. And again, like not to put them on the same plane as like designing a tool for a shop or something. But if you're making a tool to be used in a system, you don't just make whatever you think will work. You talk to people, you figure out what's needed, the exact metrics down to the very last detail, and then you design it, you test it, and then you make it. We need to do the same thing with when you do educate people or try and place them into the systems. I mean, you can't just throw people in there with whatever training you think will work. You have to really work with the market, work with employers. Then doing that, I mean, not doing that, not working with them, just goes in and turns people off again to the whole system that might help them.
Yeah. And it comes right back to a system of patronage, ultimately, which patronage is, you know, I will give you money in return for votes. And that has been going on, especially in inner city America, for the last 50 years. I wanted to read a quote that he had in the book from Benjamin Franklin. Love this quote. Sums up way better than I could a philosophy on helping the poor. Benjamin Franklin says, quote, "I am for doing good to the poor, but I differ in opinion of the means. I think the best way of doing good to the poor is not making them easy in poverty, but leading or driving them out of it. In my youth, I traveled much, and I observed in different countries that the more public provisions were made for the poor, the less they provided for themselves, and of course became poorer. And on the contrary, the less was done for them, the more they did for themselves, and became richer. And then I love Peter Cove's follow-on sentence to that quote. He says, "Welfare programs devoid of reciprocal responsibility drive out the industriousness of the individual." I think that perfectly sums it up right there.
Yeah, that's really good. I was reading, kind of go along with that, I was reading a report, came out last week, and it said an annual report by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development classifies a family of four living in San Francisco, San Mateo, or Marion counties that earn less than $117,000 as low income, which says that they are eligible for federal housing assistance and food and child care assistance, which, again, is like, wow, that is a lot of money, making that much per year. And saying that takes the responsibility off the private market to figure out the solution, long-lasting solutions, and letting the private companies and private housing markets and contractors and housing development builders, and it takes all the responsibility off them and just gives it to the government to just help people out with money, rather than they're just putting a Band-Aid over the problem. They're not actually solving the problem of housing, low housing opportunities, and the tightness of communities. They're saying, all right, well, rather than solving it, we'll and building more houses or giving you guys more land to use for neighborhoods and communities, let's just throw more money at you guys and that'll solve it. It just doesn't work at all.
So at the end of the book, Peter proposes a solution, which is basically, let's gut our entire social work assistance programs as they stand today, and let's re-divert all that money, which comes to about $270 billion, into basically a guaranteed job environment, a single course of action that mixes private and public job placement organizations to basically guarantee everybody a job, to provide a job for everybody through a mix of federal subsidies and job placement programs. And then he also believes that, a percentage of that, I think he says 20%, 25%, of strictly public sector jobs, mainly revolving around infrastructure style projects. That's an oversimplification, but that is a big idea. And it was interesting reading it, from my fairly conservative point of view. There was a lot of things in that made me uncomfortable and a little bit squeamish. And then I kind of flipped my brain and put myself in a little bit more progressive mind of view, and I got even more squeamish. But I think it's a good idea that's worthy of debate. And again, we're not going to get into all the details here, but just on its face, what did you think of his idea of for solving poverty, for attacking poverty in this way?
I thought it was very interesting and very very good for food, thought food, if you want to put it that way. He says it, I can't remember where he says it, but he's like, I don't have all the, I think it's at the end of the book. He's like, I don't have all the answers. He's like, but this is what I'm proposing. And if we get a lot of people to talk about it, more solutions will arise. And this plan can be tweaked until it fits perfect. And I'm kind of the same with you. I think if we can get everyone talking about this system and this idea, then it can be, as long as we say, all right, we're not going to slowly change it back into where the government's controlling it all and the government's like just has that safety net just in case it fails. No, if we go 100% into whatever plan based on what he said that society comes up as best fit, then I think it would probably, I don't think, I know it would make a huge difference. It might not be the drastic huge numbers, but at least do better than what we have now.
Yeah. Well, and again, I'm relatively uncomfortable with talking about growing public sector jobs, but I think it's undeniable that we have big infrastructure needs in our country. I mean, we've been talking about an infrastructure bill since the bailouts first started, and hardly any of that money made it into our public roadways or mass transit or airports or whatever ports. So we have a need there. And we're giving out so much money. I mean, we spent $22 trillion just in handouts and in disability. And we also have a lot of evidence starting in the late 90s, states and even the feds started moving towards more of a work if you're going to be on welfare. There was a work requirement. And whenever that was put into place, the number of people on welfare dropped dramatically. And generally, the number of people below the poverty line dropped as well. So while I am uncomfortable with just ballooning the public sector, I do think that I would rather spend, if we're going to spend money going after poverty, which I think that debate is, it can be had, but if we're going to, let's at least give people a chance to be personally responsible, to be contributing to society, and let's provide jobs. I think that's the best way to do it. Again, in our current climate, whether we can actually do that and whether the government can design programs that are flexible enough to change as we get more data and we can grow with that data remains to be seen. It's been awesome and completely flexible and able to be changed. But I think it's worth a shot. I think almost anything is better than what we have going on right now.
Yeah, and it's not like it wouldn't be like you said, ballooning the public sector. I mean, we'd be eliminating a lot of other things. So in reality, it might even just stay a similar size. Yeah, it might probably grow a little, but ultimately we'd be switching a lot of things over to that. So just more focused rather than a really broad brushstroke, it'd be more focused. So, I mean, it wouldn't be like ballooning it, but...
Yeah. I mean, it'd definitely be growing, but you know, he's talking about trying to add 5.5 million jobs, all going to be relatively low paying, but with opportunities for advancement. And again, 20% of those are going to be public sector. So 1.2 million. That's a big number. That's a lot of jobs, but think of the amount of productivity that could be accomplished if we could get that many people back into the workforce. Another idea that he talks at some length about is the earned income tax credit. We've all seen that on our tax returns at one point or another, or at least you have if you've read your tax return. And it's not a handout. It's basically a way of rebating money or providing a tax credit to people who are gainfully employed and part of the workplace. And I really like that idea. I mean, generally, it still is the government shuttling money from the high end of the income bracket to the low end, which I'm philosophically uncomfortable with. But it strictly as a means of fighting poverty, it incentivizes people to get into the workplace. And that's an area that Peter proposes growing to a large degree, which I think would be a great way to provide a true safety net that doesn't become a web. And if it is a web, it entangles you in doing work, which seems like a relatively good thing anyways.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know like a lot of people would be uncomfortable with like what you're saying, so many more public sector jobs, a lot more government workers, but it doesn't have to be like a long-term thing. Put a time limit on it. Like a lot of private sector jobs and projects have time limits on them. So put a time limit on it. Say, all right, well, we're going to do this for 15, 20 years, and then it's going to be phased out because by that time, hopefully, if it all works, the private sector will be growing so much that there'll be plenty of jobs for people to enter, and the poverty rate should stay low. I mean, we don't have to be like, all right, from now on, we're going to continue to create millions of public sector jobs. I mean, we put a time limit on it.
I think it's also important that this conversation continues to take place at all levels of American society. I think that this is a conversation we need to be having. And we also need to recognize that there is not going to be an ideologically pure solution to poverty. There's just not. It's too big of a problem. There's the different camps are too far apart that if we want to accomplish anything of substance, we're going to have to compromise. And I think that Peter's solution, there's a lot of compromising from both ends of the political spectrum. And maybe his ideas need to be tweaked, or maybe they need to be thrown in the bin and we need to start over. But I think that they're a great framework to at least have a discussion and try to come to some sort of a consensus that we can build from as a nation to attack poverty.
Real fast, throw this in there, kind of like a Stephen Colbert's quote he had in there. He's like, I hold a little fundraiser every day. It's called going to work. It's like one way to look at it.
Yep, that is definitely one way to look at it. Again, a lot more that could be said here, really scratching the surface. Brad, what's your, after reading this book, you know, would you have any questions that you'd want to ask Peter kind of as we're wrapping up here?
Yes and no. I mean, not really about anything he has to say, because ultimately right now I'm still kind of chewing through it and thinking through it and trying to understand everything he's talking about and stuff. But ultimately it's like, how did you not just give up halfway through your career? Just be like, how have you done it? Like, kept at it. I mean, he's been shut down by so many politicians, been thrown under the bus by so many different non-for-profits. Everyone he talks to, not everyone, but most people he talks to just has some sort of criticism for him. Like, and he's still going at it though. I mean, he's still positive. He's still happy in what he's doing. What kept him motivated?
Yeah, he's been working in that sphere for 50 years. I mean, a lot of people won't have 50-year careers, and he's been doing social work for 50 years. That was the question that I wrote down as well. Why do you do what you do? What is your why? I'd love to know that and get to know him a little bit better as a person. So Poor No More by Peter Cove. I would highly recommend the book if you have any inclination towards public policy or the war on poverty. If that strikes you as something that you're passionate about, or you want to grow in your ability to help find solutions for these problems, I think that this is a great think piece. It's not that long, very readable, even if it will raise your blood pressure from time to time, no matter which end of the political spectrum you're coming from. So I would recommend it. Like Brad said, a little bit more of an intellectual read, not quite as much on the personal development side. You know, there's not maybe quite as many application points, but definitely a place in the governmental sphere where we can take principles that we've talked about in our own personal lives, like goal setting and task management, and zoom them out and apply them to much bigger situations, to nationwide issues and problems, and evaluate, are we attacking these problems in the most effective way possible? So that's my two cents on the book. How about you, Brad?
Yeah, he goes through a whole bunch of different areas of this whole topic. He goes through the history of it. He goes through numbers, like number data, so you can actually see what he's talking about. He talks about how for-profits and non-profits are run, the difference, why they should run different in some areas, why they should run the same in some areas. He talks about the different political parties and what each party views, and how they have each had their own fingers in where we have gotten to today. I thought it was interesting how he talks in favor of both political parties, but also against both political parties. It stood out as like, yeah, we need to accept some people's ideas and accept the other people's ideas. We all have to be part of the solution. It can't be one party or the other party. It can't be the rich people or poor people. It can't be middle-class people. It has to be everyone. That really jumped out at me. So he goes through a lot of different things. He goes through the health benefits of work, education versus non-education, speed versus slow, respecting people. So it was a really good read. Got me thinking a lot. Got a lot of good conversations at work through it. Not as many as a privilege book went through. I think this is a more of a privilege is something everyone's really very willing to jump onto. Poverty is something people tread lightly around, because I believe they're a little bit more hesitant on just putting their ideas out there because they might get slaughtered or whatever, what be it.
I would agree with all that. Application for you. This book is a little bit unique. I think the applications are going to be a little bit different, but what did you have for personal application or a personal takeaway that stood out to you, Brad?
besides how it changed how I think about the whole situation, basically just thinking about the whole root cause of poverty differently and starting to talk to people about it. Kind of along the same lines as the Perils of Privilege application, is just talking to people about it and getting the conversations going more often so that more people are thinking about it and talking through it.
I think I had two takeaways or applications. The first one was that the poverty is a solvable problem. There's hope. It would be easy if you're in Peter Cove's position to really be doubtful. And he definitely paints a realistic picture. It's not all rosy. And he even admits that his ideas are revolutionary, countercultural, and going to be extremely difficult to implement in the current political climate. But there is a path to spending far less money for far greater result in our war on poverty as a nation. I firmly believe that. And this book was encouraging to me in that regard. And then the second takeaway for me was this book reinforced to me the importance of aligning government priorities with the marketplace at large or capitalism to solve issues. And I think that Peter's organization, America Works, is a perfect example. It's a for-profit entity that is aligning with governments. It's taking contracts to place workers. They're making money by getting people into jobs and then helping them keep their jobs and advance. That's a perfect marriage of trying to solve an issue that's really, it's a governmental priority, but the way that we're going to deploy our financial resources is in line with the greater marketplace. We're using capitalism as it should be used, and we're not bastardizing the system into some sort of cronyism-based politics, which I think is really important. So again, hope that we can solve it and that capitalism, when properly used, is probably the best way to go. Again, doing an economics book at some point down the line, digging more into different systems of economics and having some of those discussions. But for now, that wraps up our discussion on Poor No More by Peter Cove. I'm going to kick it over to you, Brad, to preview our next book.
Yeah, our next book is Entree Leadership by Dave Ramsey. We've talked about Dave Ramsey here and there, some of his concepts. In Richest Man in Babylon. So Entree Leadership is a book about leadership and how are you growing as a leader? Your team will never grow beyond you. So are you growing? It's a practical step-by-step guide to grow your business where you want to go. Inspire your team, unify your team, and how to handle money in your team and business and reaching goals. So I'm excited to read it. I've read it before a couple times and going through it again, I just love what he has to say and what he's going through. So
perfect. I'm really looking forward to getting into that. I've read several of Dave Ramsey's books, but I have not read this one yet. So Brad mentioned it as one of his favorites. We put it on our list and I've been excited to get to it. As we wrap up here, we welcome any feedback that you might have for us. Please hit us up on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We're all there. Please subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a rating or a review if you enjoyed, or even if you have critical feedback for us. We welcome any and all feedback. So thank you to those of you who have listened, who continue to listen, and who have provided feedback. We've tried to incorporate bits and pieces of that into our show, and we trust that we are providing interesting content that is of value to you. So help us continue to do a better job of creating good content by providing us helpful feedback. So we are looking at expanding our reach. We're going to be going into several different new platforms here in the upcoming weeks. And we're also going to try a new podcast format in our next episode. Our next one is not going to be Entree Leadership. We're going to try reviewing an article on men leaving the workplace. It's going to be a little bit shorter. We're going to do it a little bit more off the cuff, probably a 10 or 15 minute podcast. So look for that coming next. Until the next time, we will catch you later. Thank you.